KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, unless otherwise noted. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please join us.
This is KBOO Portland. The time now is 9 o'clock, and coming up next is Alternative Radio.
In celebration of our 50th anniversary, KABU is teaming up with the Mississippi Records Music and Film Series. KABU will be hosting Killer of Sheep on Wednesday, October 3rd at 7:30 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater in Portland. Filmed in Watts in 1975, Killer of Sheep follows a working man in a moment of existential crisis, trying to make ends meet at a job he finds repugnant, and trying to connect with his family and community. The Library of Congress declared Killer of Sheep a national treasure and one of the first 50 films on the National Film Registry. Again, that's Killer of Sheep on Wednesday, October 3rd, at 7:30 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO programming is made possible by KABU listener members and support from Portland Saturday Market. 45 years of handmade arts and crafts, freshly prepared international foods, and local music in downtown Portland, featuring live music and Kids Corner events. Portland Saturday Market every Saturday and Sunday in Waterfront Park, now through Christmas Eve. Event schedule, vendor information, and more is available online at portlandsaturdaymarket.com.
It was indeed Euro-American expansionism that made the United States what it is today, but expansionism so bloody that it worked hand in glove with genocide as it made its way across the continent. The American Holocaust is a matter of history. While it is essential that we as a nation face up to the genocidal realities of our past, that's only the beginning. The simmering bigotry and malign neglect of the present continue to kill those people among us whose ancestors first settled this land thousands and thousands of years ago. It's way past time for the nation as a whole and for all of us to begin repairing that terrible damage.
That's David Stannard, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features David Stannard on Native American Holocaust. The barbarity of the onslaught on indigenous people by Euro-American settlers can scarcely be believed. Historian David Stannard says the indigenous peoples of North and South America had undergone the worst human holocaust the world had ever witnessed. Roaring across two continents nonstop for four centuries, and consuming the lives of countless tens of millions of people. The Native American Holocaust is a historical fact. I'm quoting Stannard now. But the wreckage that it caused remains vividly evident among many of its survivor descendants. Today, from the desert southwest of Arizona to the Black Hills of South Dakota, many American Indian communities barely survive, mired in poverty and despair that has little equal except in some so-called desperately impoverished third world countries, unquote. Yet to add insult to injury, Columbus Day is still a federal holiday. But in defiance, many cities have changed the name to Indigenous Peoples Day. To talk about the Native American Holocaust is David Stannard, an award-winning historian. He taught at the University of Hawaii. He's the author of many books, including The Puritan Way of Death, Before the Horror, and American Holocaust, The Conquest of the New World. This never-before-broadcast classic from the AR Archive was recorded at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee, in 2008. And now, David Stannard.
Holocaust is a very old word, dating back to at least the 13th century, and originally meaning a sacrifice consumed by fire or a burnt offering. Later, around the 15th century, it began taking on a more general and secular meaning, specifically a great slaughter or sacrifice. Thus, in the early 16th century, the famous Spanish friar Bartolomé de las Casas used the word Holocaust to describe the Spaniards' ongoing destruction of immense numbers of native people in the Caribbean and Latin America. Holocaust also was used on various occasions from the 16th through the 18th centuries in reference to the massacres of Irish civilians by English soldiers and colonists. And among other instances, in the late 19th century, the word Holocaust appeared in a New York Times headline above a story describing the slaughter of more than 5,000 Armenians in eastern Turkey, part of an ongoing mass killing campaign there. Holocaust again appeared repeatedly during World War II, as historian Peter Novick has observed in reference, and I'm quoting Novick, to the totality of destruction wrought by the Axis, not to the special fate of the Jews. In fact, Novick points out only in the 1960s, in the aftermath of the trial in Israel of the Nazi criminal Adolf Eichmann, did English language publications begin referring to the Holocaust, a loosely translated reference to the Hebrew word Shoah. Like most people, I commonly refer in speaking and writing to the Holocaust, with exclusive reference to the slaughter of 6 million Jews in the Nazis' massive extermination campaign. But I don't believe it makes sense to expect the word Holocaust suddenly to disappear from the English language following World War II, except with reference to the Nazi Judeocide. By this same logic, we should be prohibited from using the word calamity, except with reference to the Armenian genocide or the 19th century Irish famine, each of which killed at least 1 million people, and each of which has been designated in capital letters and in quotes, the great calamity by their victims. The same logic would suggest that we strike the word devouring from everyday speech, since that is the English translation of porimus, the capitalized Roma word for the genocide perpetrated against gypsies by the Nazis. Other examples of genocide victims using a particular word to memorialize their suffering, of course, abound. It just doesn't make sense to banish a word from everyday usage because one group or another has adopted it in reference to their victimization. And no doubt, that's why my use of the word Holocaust, not the Holocaust, in referring to the destruction of the indigenous peoples in the Americas, actually was very little remarked upon, much more controversial, was my use of another word, and that word was genocide. One of the reasons that became controversial is that by employing it, I was joining an ongoing debate about the uniqueness of the Holocaust. And I'll talk about that debate, the uniqueness debate, shortly. But first, it's important to have some sense of why many people who knew nothing about that debate were still instantly resistant to my use of the word genocide. American Holocaust was published on Columbus Day, 1992. Earlier that same year, Oxford University Press also published a book by the prominent literary scholar and cultural critic Jane Tompkins, then of Duke University. Her book was entitled West of Everything, with the West referring to the American West. It was a sweeping and a wide-ranging book that included discussions of women in the West, white women at least, popular Western fiction, Buffalo Bill, and much else. Even had a separate chapter on horses, and another separate chapter on cattle. Only one thing was missing. Indians, the native people of the West. How could that happen? Tompkins addressed the question in her preface. "I forgot," is what she wrote. That's what she said. "I forgot." Although, to be fair, she did express regret for forgetting. As she put it, and I'm quoting her, The Indians had been decimated by disease, removal, and conquest, and now I had ignored them. So she wrote, I cried. And then she returned to putting the final touches on her manuscript. I don't recount this story to be critical of Jane Tompkins, but rather to suggest that her self-confessed memory loss was representative and in some ways perhaps symbolic of the attitudes of most Americans, and understandably so. That's the way it's supposed to be. Consider this. In the late 1940s, following almost three centuries of colonial and then federal assaults on Indians, from mass murder, land confiscation, ethnic cleansing by way of forced removal, and then confinement of the small remnant of survivors to what were often barren enclaves known as reservations, the American government decided to establish an Indian policy it officially called liquidation. When some people pointed out that in the immediate aftermath of World War II, that term might suggest unsavory connotations, the government changed it to termination. Whatever the allegedly fine distinction between those two words, the specific words themselves don't matter. Either one was fully appropriate to what was planned. The idea behind the new policy was to extinguish once and for all everything that was Indian about Indians by abolishing their tribes and their treaty relationships while seizing what was left of their land. It was to be an extermination campaign, not one aimed at individual lives, but at the entirety of these indigenous peoples' greatly varied and distinctive ethnicities, nationalities, cultures, and religions, all of which are tied to tribal identities and ancestral land bases. The Indians, of course, resisted this extermination campaign, just as they had resisted invasion and conquest and annihilation for centuries. But in just a dozen years, between 1954 and 1966, when the policy itself finally was terminated, more than 100 tribes and bands had been dissolved, and more than 1.3 million acres of Indian land had been taken. This was on top of the countless other tribes, millions of lives, and 2 billion acres of land that had been destroyed, lost, or seized from Indians before the end of the 19th century. So perhaps it's not surprising that Jane Tompkins forgot about the Indians. That was the whole idea. And actually, by 1992, when American Holocaust was published, such forgetfulness was a comparatively benign attitude, considering how many other historians and pundits preferred to figuratively dance on the Indians' graves. One culprit, among many, was someone whose name you may know, Christopher Hitchens. I single him out only because he was not at that time a predictable reactionary, but was in one of his self-proclaimed leftist phases and still writing as a columnist for The Nation. As Columbus Day drew near, Hitchens briefly acknowledged in his column that American Indians had indeed suffered as the Euro-American Empire rolled over them. And then he celebrated that historical fact, charging that those who might lament the horrors of the Indians' experience were, and I'm quoting his words here, self-hating, ridiculous, ignorant, and sinister people, unable to face the simple fact that the massive destruction of technologically backward peoples, quote, happens to be the way history is made. Hitchens announced that he, for one, would celebrate those centuries of horror with great vim and gusto. Well, this is an attitude with a long history and, unfortunately, a widespread and indeed international presence even today. Perhaps some of you know the name Benny Morris, a professor of history at Ben-Gurion University in Israel and a prominent author of books on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. A few years ago, he decided to bring American Indians into that discussion. In an interview with the distinguished Israeli newspaper Haaretz, a piece that was entitled Survival of the Fittest, Morris was discussing how he recently had come to justify what he openly called, and I'm quoting him here, ethnic cleansing during the 1948 uprooting of 700,000 Palestinians to establish the Jewish state, unquote. After all, he explained, you can't make an omelet without breaking eggs. Even the great American democracy could not have been created without the annihilation of the Indians. There are cases in which the overall final good justifies harsh and cruel acts that are committed in the course of history. The Haaretz interviewer described Morris's words as chilling, terrible, hard to listen to. He was shocked, but he shouldn't have been. Murderous immorality of this sort and the racism that is routinely interlaced with it are commonly encountered in this particular intellectual territory. They are part of its context. And that is because, as the old cliché has it, history is written by the victors. However, it's quite a different story on those rare occasions when the perpetrators of genocide lose. Take the most infamous case of all, Germany in the 1930s and 40s, when, to adopt Benny Morris's own self-justifying terminology, the ideology of the Nazi regime perceived an overall final good to be derived from what it regarded as the justifiable annihilation of Jews, Gypsies, and others. Today in Germany, because the Nazis lost, there is no equivalent of Christopher Hitchens celebrating the destruction of Jews with great vim and gusto, at least not in the pages of one of that country's oldest and most liberal and respected magazines. On the contrary, to deny the very existence of the Holocaust in Germany is a criminal offense that can lead to imprisonment, as it can in other European countries as well. Moreover, Germany is home to at least 8 major Holocaust memorials or museums, among more than 60 similar institutions throughout the world, including a dozen or so in the United States. And this is as it should be. But where in Germany is the memorial to, say, the Herero people? The Herero are one of several national and ethnic groups in Southwest Africa who also felt Germany's genocidal wrath, but decades before the Holocaust, at the turn of the 20th century. By the time the killing ended, 2/3 of the natives of that region had been wiped out by the Germans, exterminated. Although the total number killed was far lower than the Holocaust, this was roughly the same rate of extermination as the one suffered by European Jews during the 1930s and 40s. Moreover, in the midst of the killing, in 1906, a German military commander published a book that justified the slaughter as necessary for attainment of what Benny Morris so cheerfully later called the overall final good. And like Morris, a century later, he used the United States' treatment of American Indians as a touchstone. This process, he wrote, referring to the extermination of what he called the weak and purposeless Africans, and I'm quoting him here, is played out elsewhere and in a variety of ways, such as, for example, in the elimination of the American Indians, because they were without purpose in the continued development of the world. They were without purpose. Note the casual past tense in referring to the millions of native people who once lived in North America alone, to say nothing of the vastly greater numbers who had lived in Mexico and Central and South America, but who by that time in North America had been reduced in number by more than 90% to several hundred thousand. An American president of that same era expressed much the same sentiment, and with equal satisfaction. He began with a comment about one particular unprovoked late 19th century raid by U.S. soldiers on an Indian community in Colorado, a raid planned specifically for a time when all the young Indian men would be away hunting, so there would only be unarmed women, children, and old men in the village. As the troops approached on horseback, the Indians waved to welcome them, and the elders held a large white flag aloft. A short time later, hundreds of Indians, almost everyone in the village, lay dead. In the aftermath, according to subsequent accounts of the soldiers themselves, they went systematically from body to body, scalping and mutilating the dead, castrating the corpses of old men and small boys. Let me just quote a snippet of one soldier's lengthy testimony before the United States Congress, and many of them testified. Quote, "The men used their knives," he said, "ripped open women, clubbed little children, beat their brains out. In numerous instances, men cut out the private parts of females and stretched them over their saddle bows and wore them over their hats while riding in the ranks. One man cut a squaw's heart out and stuck it up on a stick." When asked about this ghastly event, President Theodore Roosevelt, a Nobel Peace Prize winner, said it was as righteous and beneficial a deed as ever took place on the frontier. Later, referring to the overall long history of the destruction of the American Indians, Roosevelt dismissed any possible concerns by saying that the Indians were, quote, an alien race that held a coveted prize in its feeble grasp, unquote. That prize was land, and the Americans wanted it. Therefore, the Indians' annihilation, the president concluded, was both, I'm quoting him again, beneficial and inevitable. Today, in the post-Holocaust era, such racist and genocidal boastfulness usually is frowned upon, at least in polite company. In its place, especially on the international stage, is the silence of denial. The silence of Belgium is an example, home to an acclaimed museum of African history and culture, a museum that until very recently made no mention anywhere of the horrors of the Congo, where more than 8 million Africans perished under the bloodthirsty colonial rule of Belgium's King Leopold, or the denial of Turkey over complicity in the Armenian genocide, or Japan over culpability for the so-called rape of Nanking, and on and on and on. There are various reasons and rationalizations behind such efforts to ignore or deny the existence of genocides or to systematically minimize their magnitude. National pride, and its flip side, potential national shame, is one reason, of course. But one nation's genocidal denial frequently is aided and abetted by a chorus of support from others, political allies around the world. Thus, one reason Turkey has been able to remain so adamant in its official denial of the Armenian genocide is support for this denial by the governments of the United States and Israel, both of them fearful of damaging bilateral trade and diplomatic relationships with Turkey. In the opposite spirit of denial, that is, the spirit of never forget, there is a wall in the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum inscribed with a warning, something Adolf Hitler reportedly said one day in 1939 on the eve of the Nazi invasion of Poland. It's a famous phrase. Who, after all, speaks today of the annihilation of the Armenians? More apt, then, on this day, I believe, nearly 70 years later, is another question. Who, after the crushing of Nazi Germany in 1945, could have imagined that the United States and Israel, of all countries, would help to perpetuate that convenient forgetfulness about the annihilation of the Armenians, and with it, Hitler's murderous cynicism on into the 21st century? Indeed, it was only a half dozen years ago that the current president of Israel, Shimon Peres, declared the Armenian genocide to be historically meaningless. This prompted a particularly angry reply from within Israel by a man named Israel Charney, the executive director of the Institute on the Holocaust and Genocide in Jerusalem. In a letter to Peres, Charney wrote that Peres had, quote, gone beyond a moral boundary that no Jew should ever allow himself to trespass, adding that specific remarks on the Armenian genocide being meaningless were comparable to denials of the Holocaust. This sort of statement is not unusual for Israel Charney. For many years, he has ferociously fought back against the evil of Holocaust denial, while at the same time resisting efforts to set the Holocaust apart, as in his words, I'm quoting him, the ultimate event against which all other tragedies of genocide, a genocidal mass death, are to be tested and invariably found wanting. For me, he writes, the passion to exclude this or that mass killing from the universe of genocide, as well as the intense competition to establish the exclusive superiority or unique form of any one genocide, ends up creating a fetishistic atmosphere in which the masses of bodies that are not to be qualified for the definition of genocide are dumped into a conceptual black hole where they are forgotten, unquote. Which finally brings me back to the genocidal destruction of North and South America's native people, and the strong resistance by some commentators to my use of the word genocide in describing that destruction. Commentators, like the recently convicted felon, Senator Ted Stevens, who threatened to use his considerable power to cut off funding of the Smithsonian Institution if it used the word genocide, as it had planned to do in a documentary film on the destruction of the America's native people. Commentators, in short, who would prefer that those millions of bodies remain buried and forgotten in Charney's conceptual black hole. For those of you unfamiliar with the story of what happened to the indigenous peoples of the Americas during the course of four long centuries, from Columbus's first landing at Hispaniola in 1492 to the massacre at Wounded Knee in December of 1890, or over the course of five centuries, if we bring accounts forward to the U.S.-supported genocide in Guatemala during the 1980s and beyond, I must confess that it is impossible for me here tonight to describe specific events in any detail. That's what I did over the course of several hundred pages in American Holocaust, and even then I barely scratched the surface of what, in North America alone, began with the deliberate, calculated extermination of the Indians of Virginia in the 17th century, what Yale genocide scholar Ben Kiernan recently described as genocide on the Carthaginian model. So total was the destruction. Let me just say for the moment, however, that the claim of Euro-American genocide as one of the primary agents responsible for the deaths of millions of indigenous people throughout the Western Hemisphere was hardly original with me. In fact, the first person to make that case was the very man who coined the word genocide and who relentlessly and heroically pressed the United Nations to declare it an international crime. A law professor and a Polish Jew who had lost 49 members of his family in the Holocaust, Raphael Lemkin. It's commonly thought that in his efforts to name and define genocide as a crime, Lemkin was focused exclusively on the then ongoing extermination of Jews in Nazi Germany, and this is incorrect. Recent research in the Lemkin archives at New York's American Jewish Historical Society, the New York Public Library, and the Marcus Center of the American Jewish Archives in Cincinnati has revealed the existence of detailed manuscript writings from the 1940s in which Lemkin, obviously preparing at least one book on genocide, probably more, left numerous folders filed under what he regarded as a variety of genocidal events in history, including, and the titles are his, quote, Spanish treatment of South American Indians, North American Indians, colon, extermination, history of genocide, projected book on North American Indian research, and much more. In a 1948 report to a foundation that was supporting his work, Lemkin listed what he called 10 specific genocide cases, this is the phrase he used, on which he was compiling information, and I quote, to be made available to the United Nations Drafting Committee on Genocide. One of those 10 cases is labeled the Indians in Latin America. Another is the Indians in North America. And then finally, in the 1950s, Lemkin's archives reveal still more folders bulging with information on these subjects, including the draft of a 100-page essay on genocide against Indians, one that includes sections on their incarceration in what he calls concentration camps. He was, of course, referring to reservations. By the late 1950s, Lemkin had almost completed a massive book on genocide in world history, the entire third section of which was to be given over to genocides in colonial settings, with separate chapter titles listed on genocide against the American Indians, Latin America, genocide against the Aztecs, the Yucatan, genocide against the Incas, and then on to European genocides against the natives of New Zealand, Australia, Southwest Africa, and more. But in 1959, Lemkin died of a heart attack in a hotel room in New York City. He was not yet 60 years old. The book was unfinished. But even if it had been completed, it probably never would have been published, because by then a new orthodoxy was beginning to take hold in the United States and elsewhere, one that viewed the Holocaust as a singular, unique, genocidal event in world history. To some proponents of this idea, the Holocaust was not only the preeminent genocide, it was the only genocide. Whereas Lemkin apparently felt that acknowledging the suffering of others had no bearing on the recognition of one's own painful experience, some among this new generation regarded the Holocaust as moral capital. To cite one representative writer, moral capital that risked being plundered by others who sought acknowledgement of their own horrific experiences. In this emerging climate of opinion, authors who chose to utter even mildly critical comments about aspects of the new orthodoxy, including such distinguished Jewish political theorists and historians as Hannah Arendt and Raoul Hilberg, found themselves being abused in print and blackballed for expressing their points of view. For the better part of three decades, this sort of exclusivist thinking dominated scholarly discussion about the Holocaust. So much so, in fact, that in the early 1990s, the distinguished Princeton historian, Arno J. Mayer, himself a Jew, found his classes being boycotted by Jewish students and his name placed in a rogues gallery of so-called Hitler apologists, published by the Anti-Defamation League. Hitler apologists. Why? Because in a book entitled Why Did the Heavens Not Darken, Mayer had dared to criticize what he saw as two camps of historical extremists. In his words, and I'm quoting him, those two camps were revisionists, who categorically deny the Judeo-side, and dogmatists, who seek to reify and sacralize the Holocaust. In this latter camp were numerous prominent scholars who vigorously condemned anyone who dared to engage in comparative genocide research. Research, wrote one such author, that might taint the Holocaust by including it as merely, and I'm quoting, one among an array of other conflagrations in which innocents were massacred, unquote. The Holocaust is unique. It stands alone. Nothing can be compared with it. So said those scholars Professor Mayer had criticized as Holocaust dogmatists. Indeed, according to historian Stephen T. Katz, writing in the 1990s, the Holocaust not only is unique, it is the only true genocide that has ever occurred. Thus, when asked in 1994 what he thought of the recent and ongoing mass killings in Bosnia and Rwanda, Katz replied that the Bosnia situation was merely, and I quote, a population transfer supported by violence, unquote. While the slaughter of 800,000 people over the course of 3 months in Rwanda was, he said, not genocidal, but simply a struggle for tribal domination. The strong influence of this line of thinking throughout much of the world of genocide scholarship at that time not only served to sacralize the Holocaust, as Mayer had put it, it also, intentionally or not, provided a cover of pseudo-respectability for those very secular political forces throughout the world, including the United States, Turkey, and elsewhere, that were interested in denying genocides that had occurred in their own backyards. This was the generally prevailing opinion on the matter when American Holocaust was published in 1992.
You're listening to David Stannard on Native American Holocaust. This is Independent Alternative Radio. You can order copies of this program by calling 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
By the mid-1990s, times were changing again. Among other things, in the wake of the Columbian Quincentennial, a City University of New York historian named Henry Huttenbach began to privately publish a small circulation newsletter called the Genocide Forum. Huttenbach, a specialist in the Holocaust, Germany, and the Soviet Union, staked out a position far different from that held by Katz and his supporters. If anything, in certain respects, it appeared more closely aligned with the thinking of such people as Israel Charney and his Jerusalem Institute on the Holocaust and Genocide. In the very first issue of the Genocide Forum, Huttenbach wrote that the narrowly exclusive focus on the Holocaust of far too many genocide scholars was inevitably leading to what he called a stifling intellectual parochialism and the dead end of antiquarianism. He called instead for a vigorous collaboration among a wide range of genocide scholars to explore what might be learned from an aggressively comparative study of this horrific phenomenon, specifically citing as clear examples of genocide deserving of more study the killing of Roma by the Third Reich, the slaughter of indigenous people in South America, and the recent mass murders in Bosnia and Rwanda. All of these were incidents that Stephen Katz and others had flatly rejected as actual genocides. Then Huttenbach took direct aim by way of a scathing review of Katz's new 700-page opus, a book entitled The Holocaust in Historical Context, that relentlessly advanced the Holocaust exclusivist line. Katz did his own reputation no favors by replying immediately with an intemperate and wildly ad hominem attack, saying that Huttenbach, and I'm quoting, would have made a good editor of Der Stürmer, unquote, the most famous and vile anti-Semitic propaganda publication of the Nazis, a publication whose actual editor was executed by the Allies after being convicted of crimes against humanity at the Nuremberg trials. Clearly, by this time, if nothing else, things were heating up in the little world of genocide scholarship. Next, out of the box, in 1995, was a book of essays edited by Alan S. Rosenbaum entitled, Is the Holocaust Unique? That volume contained pieces on the Nazi extermination campaign against Gypsies, the Atlantic slave trade, the Armenian genocide, the Stalinist terror famine, the case of the American Indians, and others, including, of course, the Holocaust. Stephen Katz wrote the essay on the Holocaust, and I wrote the one on American Indians. The entire affair became something of a colorful, if minor, academic scandal when one of the authors, me, received a misaddressed fax revealing that the editor of the book had been sending the other contributors' essays to his friend, Professor Katz, so that he might anticipate and deal with their arguments in his own essay. Katz also was serving as something of a ghost editor, recommending to Rosenbaum deletions in some essays, including mine, that were critical of Katz and his work. For better or worse, however, this little tempest did bring outside attention to bear on what was becoming an otherwise arcane academic dispute, and conveniently a dispute that at that moment finally was reaching consensus on one essential point. That consensus was that if the Holocaust was to be shown as unique, beyond the trivial ways in which all major historical events possess unique characteristics, it would have to be based on the matter of demonstrated genocidal intent by the perpetrator, not on the magnitude of a particular slaughter, the percentage of people killed, the speed of the killing, or anything else, because it had by that time been fully demonstrated that in each of these categories, other groups of genocide victims from the very distant to the very recent past had equal or stronger claim to the dubious mantle of most extreme victimhood. Alas, however, as by now you might have guessed would happen, this consensus only led to some further dispute, this time specifically regarding the definition of the word intent. Without the luxury of a second entire lecture on the problems of defining intent, then, let me simply assure you that the fine points of distinction among various ways of calculating genocidal intent in contemporary human rights cases provide no impediment to the overpowering case that now exists for recognizing genocide as a driving force in the Euro-American conquest of the Americas, or other previously disputed genocides for that matter. Last year, even the Anti-Defamation League has now acknowledged that the Armenians did indeed suffer a genocide. Although it has been a contentious passage from the publication of American Holocaust, there really is no longer much question as to what the proper term should be for the euphemism of American expansion, the phrase that most of us learned in our high school and college history classes. It was indeed Euro-American expansionism that made the United States what it is today, but expansionism so bloody that it worked hand in glove with genocide as it made its way across the continent. If we are now, as a nation, edging closer to a widespread recognition of that reality, however, another critical task lies ahead. The American Holocaust is a matter of history, but the wreckage that it caused remains vividly evident among many of its survivors' descendants today. From the desert southwest of Arizona to the Black Hills of South Dakota and beyond, many American Indian communities barely survive, mired in poverty and despair that has little equal except in some of the world's most desperately impoverished so-called third world countries. Alcoholism, diabetes, and suicide rates are sky high, while infant mortality and life expectancy rates at places like Pine Ridge Reservation are as bad as in Haiti and some of the poorest countries of Africa. At the University of Hawaii, I teach a course on race and racism, and one of the central things I try to make clear is that racism kills. It's not just American Indians. Low-income black men have a median life expectancy roughly 10 years below the national average. Multiply those 10 years by the number of low-income black males in a single generation, and the result is the equivalent of hundreds of thousands of lifetimes that should have been lived, but that weren't. And it's not just the poverty. Racism as an agent unto itself is a killer. Recent research, initiated by a group of physicians in Chicago, is showing that college-educated, middle-class black women give birth to premature and dangerously underweight babies at almost three times the rate of comparably educated and situated white women in America. I should note that preterm birth not only is a leading cause of death in infants, but those who survive face a high probability of lifetimes damaged by learning disabilities, hypertension, diabetes, and coronary artery disease. Since this research controls for differences in education and income, all the indicators point to extreme stress as the primary cause of this health crisis. The stress of simply living day to day as a black woman, regardless of social class, in a deeply racist society. Of course, what I'm talking about here regarding African Americans is the pathological residue of centuries of slavery, Jim Crow, and ongoing institutional racial discrimination today. The same imposed pathologies are insidiously at work in many American Indian communities, and the damage being done is heartbreaking. Thus, while it is essential that we as a nation face up to the genocidal realities of our past, that's only the beginning. The simmering bigotry and malign neglect of the present continue to kill those people among us whose ancestors first settled this land thousands and thousands of years ago. It's way past time for the nation as a whole and for all of us to begin repairing that terrible damage. Thank you.
So you said at one point that the American Holocaust is an event of the past, but the wreckage from it is something that we're still dealing with today. And I'm just wondering if maybe I can push you on that a little bit, because I'm wondering if maybe it's the case that it actually is something that still persists, in the sense that we don't see government forces going out and slaughtering, in a physical sense, indigenous communities, but in a way we've seen colonialism works so well that now there doesn't need to be the forces going out and doing it. Right. We've actually made it so that communities are very, very good at kind of exterminating themselves. Especially I'm thinking in terms of North American reserve communities that have the highest rates of
suicide,
violence
and alcoholism,
drug dependency, incredibly low literacy rates, mm-hmm. and also kind of just the widespread ability of like mainstream political society to make all of those things invisible to us so that they don't come up, so that we don't actually talk about them, so that we can talk about race and racism without actually talking about indigenous people at all. And so I'm wondering if maybe you'd be willing to say that it's still going on, or if there's a particular reason why it stopped.
I would take issue just with one thing that you said, and it may have just been a term that you would not maybe perhaps have wanted to use, or maybe you do. You suggested that somehow or other the system had become so efficient, I think. That's not your word or your phrase, but that the people were doing it to themselves, that were destroying themselves. And to me, that's edging very close to blaming the victims. Ultimately, they're not doing it to themselves. Even those who are committing suicide, I think, are not doing it to themselves. Again, that's a fine point, I think. But in saying that, what I'm really saying is that I agree with you. That yes, this has become a kind of machine that goes of itself, in the same way that we can have deeply racist society without any overt evidence of hate speech, and racial hatred apparent on the surface of the society because we've created institutions that are institutionally racist and simply take care of business on their own without all the rhetoric that was associated with racism in the past. So I agree with that. I guess the distinction that I would make, because I did conclude American Holocaust at the end of the 19th century, although I did make references to the killing in Latin America in the horrible, horrible genocidal killing in Latin America in the 1980s, comes back to the question of the word genocide. Historians over the many years have tried to figure, and some historians have just made up definitions of genocide. And the reason they made up definitions is because the Genocide Convention of the United Nations was cobbled together by a group of nations to somehow make sense of and to institutionalize a law that would say this, we cannot have this anymore. This is illegal, and nations must act against it. So in order to do that, they had to define it. The problem is, who is sitting around defining this? People who represent countries that in the past and at that time were committing genocide. I mean, it was like having the thieves sit around the table writing the law. So, for example, Lemkin had always had in his definition of genocide whole groups of political people who were being exterminated because of their politics. The Soviet Union would have nothing to do with that because they had how many people in the gulags at the moment that they're sitting down writing this genocide convention? They simply could not have that. As a result, technically, the genocide in Cambodia was not genocide. And there are very, very few genocide scholars who will say that it was genocide. But most of the genocide scholars in the world today would say it was horrible, but the victims were political victims, and that's why it's not a genocide. The same thing with the killing of Indians in Paraguay. The killers were able to extricate themselves by saying, yes, we killed all of those people, almost exterminated an entire people. But it wasn't because of the fact that they were Indians, which would have made them a protected group, but because their political activities were such that they deserved being exterminated. And therefore, yes, maybe that was not very humanitarian, and maybe it was a crime against humanity and so on and so forth, but it's not genocide. Anyway, that's one of the reasons why historians have tried, many historians and sociologists who write about genocide, have tried to create their own definitions of genocide. The problem with that is your definition includes this group, my definition includes that group, such as taking children, as the United Nations Convention does, taking children away from families and putting them among others, as has happened in Australia, most famously, and so on, and others don't. So therefore, then you've lost everything. So I think that really what we need to do, and I don't like this because I think the Genocide Convention has real problems, is that we just simply have to hold to the UN Genocide Convention. It's the only one, the only thing, that the definition that exists that most people have bought into. I guess what I'm saying, to come back to your point, which I think is a very good one, is that I think we should stay within the UN definition and fight about issues within that. And in that case, then we have to accept the word intent, however we define it, as part of the justification for our use of the term genocide.
Okay, just one super quick follow-up. Sure. Like, I think that, so I agree with you about the intent, but I just want to, like, say that I think that the intent to exterminate has been replaced in a really large way by the intent to assimilate, which I am not sure is all that. Like, if you look at the residential school policy, I'm Canadian, so I know the residential schools system in Canada a lot better, but if you look at the residential school policy, I'm not sure that you can pull apart the intent to exterminate with the intent to assimilate in that kind of example. So
yeah, and actually a case can be made that the Genocide Convention does cover that, and people have written about that in Canada and again in Australia in particular. Yeah.
Well, as somebody who is Native American, I'm Cherokee and Muscogee. Basically, my family all ran off during the removal and hid out. I've lived on three different reservations And my kids are all members of fairly recognized tribes. When you're looking at genocide as a Native person, there was the physical genocide. There is the de facto genocide. I grew up right here in Nashville, and I grew up around mainstream society being a person from a completely separate culture and having to deal with, why can't you just be an American? Why are you still speaking that language? And the schools still do this. My kids have had to fight the very same fights in school that I had to fight, that my mother had to fight, and so forth and so on, where you get one little chapter of maybe four pages and a few paragraphs, and it's so general it's useless. It talks about the Aztecs, it talks about the southeastern people, and may mention the Cherokees and the Creeks. It talks about the northeastern people, and it usually mentions the Mohawks. And then it mentions Lakotas. And it's just useless. It's not taught. People don't understand that three-fifths of all the world's food crops were developed right here in the Western Hemisphere. Most of the medicines that most people use came from here. We were not only the greatest agriculturalists on the face of the earth, we were also the greatest pharmaceutical botanists. Now, some of it, the alcoholism, the drug abuse, the dysfunction that exists within families, a lot of people wouldn't know it, and I hate to admit it, but sexual abuse amongst Native Americans is astronomically higher than it is for the rest of the population. It started with the boarding schools or residential schools, because you had kids that were taken at the age of five. They didn't see their families for 7 or 8 years. How can you be normal when you're not raised in a family? When you're put into boarding school and you are beaten for speaking your native language, you're mistreated, you're sexually abused. Every time they go to an old boarding school site and they start excavating because somebody's going to build something else, they start finding skeletons. Probably 25% of Native American children who went into the boarding schools disappeared. And they were never found. Those are people who never got to grow up, who never got to contribute. And we weren't put in those boarding schools to make us doctors or lawyers or leaders. We were put in there so that the girls could become domestic servants and the boys could become manual laborers. That was the only purpose. It was to make us servants. The thing is, the genocide's still going on because the cultural pressures that are on Native people are still forget who you are, become who we say you are. And that's not just the blend into society, that's the fit into our little mythology that we have about you people, which actually to me is a lot more insulting than somebody saying, why can't you just be an American? You know, I didn't live in teepee. My people never lived in teepees. We were farmers. And if I don't fit into your stereotype of how I'm supposed to be, I try to be nice about it, but sometimes it's just like, you know, well, that's just tough for you if you can't accept that. There's other ways I put it that are not really appropriate for use in public. You know, that's how it goes.
Okay, can I make one comment on what you said? And American Indians are not all the same. There are hundreds of different original Native nations, each of which had distinctive religious traditions, cultural traditions and ways of doing things, ways of living, and physiological differences. American Indians don't all look the same. They're very different. And the reason this is relevant to the question of genocide is because if there's one thing that I wish I hadn't said in American Holocaust, reference to genocide in the singular, what really happened was serial genocide that took place over and over and over and over again over the course of 400 years, in some cases of which the entire people were obliterated. Nothing remained. In other cases, not all Indian groups suffered genocide. Some didn't. But the variations are tremendous. When I was entered graduate school, I was going to study slavery and racism, but mostly slavery in the United States, and I chose not to because I decided that a white guy should not be studying slavery. In the same way, that when I've written about Native peoples in the Pacific and about American Indians, I don't claim to really be writing about Indians. I'm writing about what white people have done to those people. So I don't really claim to know much about American Indians, but from what little I do know, I think it's important for us to recognize how incredibly varied those groups of people are. Continue to be, but at one time, astonishingly were, when the numbers in North America, nobody knows what they were. The lowest estimates have ranged anywhere from 5 million to 15 million. Within those 500 nations that existed, there was extraordinary variability and difference. Anyway, that's all. And I'm glad you brought that up. Thank you.
You were just listening to David Stannard on Native American Holocaust. This classic from the AR Archive was recorded at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee in 2008. David Stannard is an award-winning historian and author of American Holocaust, The Conquest of the New World. This program is produced by Alternative Radio based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and part of the nonprofit media education organization Rise Up. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature progressive voices rarely heard in the media, such as Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, Russell Means, Ralph Nader, Winona LaDuc, Yanis Varoufakis, and Francis Fox Piven. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for CDs, MP3s, or written transcripts of today's program, David Stannard on Native American Holocaust, call us at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that number is 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order on our website, alternativeradio.org. Joe Ricci is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. We go out with the Eulalie Project, Idle No More.
We're KABU is proud to co-sponsor the Palestinian Film Festival, October 5th to the 7th, at the Fifth Avenue Cinema in downtown Portland. From Friday evening to Sunday afternoon, the theater will feature films by and about Palestinians and the Israeli occupation.
The Stones Cry Out, a film about Palestinian Christians, will play on Friday, October 5th. Then, The Wanted 18, about the nonviolent struggle in Beit Sahur and the herd of 18 cows that Israel deemed a national security threat.
The Occupation of the American Mind, Steadfast Hope, and more.
You can find a link to tickets for the event on KBOO.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland. And coming up next is Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. Air Cascadia is off today. At 11 is Stage and Studio. Stage and Studio presents the documentary Coming Home, Return of the Alutiiq Masks.